Okay, and we are moving on to the final case on our calendar today, scheduled for oral argument. Just as a reminder, welcome to the Court of Appeals. It's Wednesday, February 7th, and I'm Judge Wheelock, sitting on a panel with Judges Sleater and Judge Schmidt, and we are in room 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. We do live stream our arguments, and we also record them. The audio recording will be available on the branch's website within 24 hours. And with that, I will have the marshal call our final case of the day.
Now calling A231186, A231248, in the matter of the Ronald E. Roars Trust, dated August 9, 1999.
Counsel, as you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes afterwards. You can adjust the podium. There is a timer on the podium showing the clock counting down. So I just ask that you introduce yourself at the beginning and introduce who your clients are. Please let us know of any pronunciations or pronouns you wish us to use. And counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Cradiville, and along with my law partner, Christina Caluza, we represent the appellant, Mr. Michael Roars. I would note that Mr. Roars is here with us in the courtroom today. And I need to start my argument by thanking the court for allowing me to be here and to appear on a pro hoc vice basis. I'm a lawyer from the state of Texas, and it's a great honor for me to be presenting oral argument here in Minnesota. My client, Michael Roars, is a native Minnesotan who resides in Texas now, and both he and I are grateful for the opportunity to have his Texas counsel represent him in this court. So thank you very much for that. Your Honors, the final judgment entered by the trial court on July 19th, 2023, is procedurally improper and procedurally problematic on multiple different levels. This is true whether the procedure that yielded that final judgment is evaluated through the lens of constitutional due process, through the lens of the Minnesota statutes governing trust disputes, and that's what this is, a trust dispute, or evaluated through the lens of the rules of civil procedures in the timelines and practices governing motions practice, specifically dispositive motions practice. Here, in this trust case, a final judgment was entered without a dispositive motion being filed, without a hearing, without a trial, and without my client having an opportunity to respond, and without the adjudication of three of the five live claims in his amended petition that was the live pleading in the case at the time of the procedurally improper final judgment. Now, how did this final judgment come to be if there was no dispositive motion filed, no hearing, no response from my client, and no trial? How could such a thing happen? Well, that's equally irregular. It appears to be the product of a very informal process involving a letter to the court on July 7th of 2023 with unauthenticated, unsworn evidence attached to it, no declaration or affidavit supporting that evidence, that the court below acted on in approximately 2 hours after receiving the July 7th letter. It issued a notice of judicial determination the same afternoon it received the July 7th letter. Now, what the July 7th letter indicated was that a new trustee had been appointed as trustee of the trust that issue in this litigation.
Counsel, can I inquire, wasn't it prior to that, though, that the district court had issued its order denying your client's request following the April 5 hearing where most all these issues were argued?
Your Honor, I think there's an important distinction between the April 5th hearing, which was a hearing on an application for preliminary injunction, not a trial on the merits, and which didn't involve the adjudication of three of the five claims brought by my brought by my client. And in addition, the order from the trial court denying the preliminary injunction on its face contemplated further proceedings. It set a status conference, scheduling conference, for August 2nd. So in denying the preliminary injunction, yes, there was a hearing on the application for preliminary injunction, and yes, that application for preliminary injunction was denied, but that was not case dispositive. As we all know, the standard for a preliminary injunction and the standard for a final judgment on the merits are very different. And in addition, my client brought five claims. Three of those claims are as follows: an accounting and review of expenditures of trust assets. That wasn't adjudicated at the PI hearing. A review of the investment of the trust assets. That claim wasn't adjudicated at the PI hearing. And a claim for judicial interpretation of certain trust language. That claim wasn't adjudicated at the preliminary injunction hearing. What was...
But is it true, at least on that third one, during the hearing, the district court agreed with respondent, I can't remember which counsel for respondent's interpretation of the language of the trust?
There is certainly language in the transcript in which the trial judge did appear to agree in dicta with their position, but a stray remark from the bench is not a final judgment, and it's a different standard at a PI hearing than on a final judgment. And in addition, Your Honor, I think this is critical, with the PI hearing, the event that they claim moots the need for further proceeding and justifies a final judgment, the replacement of the former trustee by the new trustee, Ms. Tharp, that hadn't happened yet. That happens in June and July. This hearing was in April. So the dispositive event, from my friends on the other side's perspective, doesn't happen until a couple of months after the preliminary injunction hearing. That's why I think the preliminary injunction hearing is a red herring.
I haven't seen this in the record, some correspondence, some motion or something from your client once the trustee correspondence started coming and led to a proposed order?
Well, things move.
In order to raise what you're raising now, as Your Honor, there's a number of issues yet that haven't been resolved, and we have a status conference coming up, and so we're planning to get to that. Was there any kind of communication with the judge?
Well, Your Honor, there wasn't, and here's why, I think. Things moved exceptionally fast between July 7th, when that letter alerting the trial court to Ms. Tharp's purported appointment as the new trustee, and the entry of final judgment on July 19th. So there's a letter on July 7th. There's the trial court's judicial determination 2 hours later saying send in a proposed order that confirms Ms. Tharp as the interim trustee, emphasis on interim. 4 days later, on July 11th, there's more correspondence and the submission of that proposed order. That proposed order, I note, does not designate Ms. Tharp as an interim trustee, but rather as a permanent full-time trustee. The trial court signs that on July 11th, and on July 19th, it closes its file and treats the July 11th order as a final judgment. So this all went at light speed.
But was there anything after that? Because a judge can vacate a final judgment if there's a request, and, oh, that's right, we've got some issues, so we don't want to do a partial, creating a partial appeal situation.
Your Honor, I think, and I was not counsel at the time, but I think there was a strategic determination. There was a strategic fork in the road, and my client had two options: to bring post-judgment motions practice in the trial court or to file its notice of appeal and come to see this court. And my client opted, as is its right, to take an appeal rather than to ask the trial judge to fix this highly procedurally irregular 4-day process without a hearing and without a response that yielded a final judgment. So I think my clients were a little shocked by the procedural informality and the way this final judgment was reached in the trial court, and that motivated my clients to say, we need to turn procedurally square corners here, and it's the Court of Appeals who will help us to do that. We wanted, the opportunity on remand to file responsive motions, to test the unauthenticated, unsworn evidence that was put in via these letters. And I think even if these letters were treated as kind of a stealth motion for summary judgment or stealth motion to dismiss as moot, we still should have the opportunity, as a matter of due process, as a matter of statutory law, and as a matter of the rules of civil procedure, to respond to a stealth summary judgment or a stealth motion to dismiss as moot. We did not have that opportunity, and there certainly was no hearing. So this litigation by letter is immensely problematic from a statutory perspective, a rules-based perspective, and even a due process perspective. And that's why I think my clients made the strategic election to come get some guidance from the Court of Appeals rather than try to continue to operate under these informal quasi-procedures in the trial court. And again, even if the July 7th letter or the July 11th correspondence is treated as some form of dispositive motion, which I don't believe on its face it can be. These are short 1- and 2-page letters. Even then, my client's claims for an accounting, for a review of investments, and for interpretation of trust language aren't addressed. All the, and I'm being generous here, construing those letters as a dispositive motion, all that dispositive motion, if that's what it was, dealt with was the removal of a trustee, saying that's moot because the prior trustee, Mrs. Marvel Roars, had resigned, and claim two, the appointment of a successor trustee in the form of Mr. Stephen Roars, which is the relief that my client had pled for. Even if the letters were a motion that were granted on an expedited basis without a hearing and without a response from us, that still leaves three claims entirely unadjudicated that need to be handled on remand and need to be resolved by the district court on remand. Those are live claims that have never been litigated in any form. The hallmark of finality is, of course, a final resolution of all claims as between all parties. And because three of my client's five claims were not adjudicated below, we need a remand to
Counsel, maybe I'm not quite understanding procedurally. What is prohibiting your client from yet addressing those claims if the only issue in the judgment, final judgment entered that's now appealed was the appointment of a successor trustee?
Well, Your Honor, I think there is still a live issue there. I think I was sort of, for purposes of argument, giving the most generous possible construction to the litigation by letter that occurred below. My clients have a different reading of Section 7D and 7B of the trust agreement by which a successor trustee is appointed. That's one of the issues we need a judicial determination on. That wasn't made on the record below. We didn't have a chance to present our contrary interpretation. It may be, based on the stray remarks during the PI hearing on April 5th, the trial court rules against us. But it doesn't mean that a remand is futile because it gives us the opportunity to make our argument, to be heard, and to make our record so that if we want to come see this court on the merits rather than on this irregular procedural process, we have that ability to come and have an adjudication of the trust language, first by the trial court on remand and then, if necessary, by this court. Right now, I can't argue the merits of the case to you because the merits haven't been adjudicated. All I can say is that there's a profoundly irregular procedural process that was followed, yielding a final judgment, and you know, we don't agree with that final judgment, but because of the unique and respectfully improper way in which that final judgment was reached, we have to focus in this visit to this court on procedure, not merits. I'd love to skip ahead to the merits, but that's impossible on this record and the way this final judgment was reached. Your Honor, in addition to the procedural irregularities that I've already described, this final judgment awards relief that was not pleaded for by any party. My clients did seek the appointment of a successor trustee in the form of Stephen Roars specifically. That was the claim, a successor trustee, because based on my client's reading of the trust language, that successor trustee had to be Mr. Stephen Roars. The respondents and the trustee who would ultimately resign, the then incumbent trustee, responded with counterclaims, invoked the court's jurisdiction, came forward with counterclaims asking for the appointment of a neutral trustee in the form of retired Judge Jared Wolf. No one in their petitions, and none of the live pleadings before the court below pleaded for the relief that was ultimately granted, the judicial acceptance of the appointment of Ms. Tharp. So again, as with the other procedures here, awarding relief that no party has asked for, except in a letter, not a motion, with no hearing and no response to that letter, is procedurally improper. Now, my friends on the other side may attempt to say, well, this is all moot because, you know, Ms. Tharp is now the trustee. But we believe there's a live issue of trust interpretation that has to be heard on remand to determine if that was the proper procedure or if the procedure we believe under Article 7 of the trust is the proper procedure. So we do not think that is a moot issue. And to be sure, the trust doesn't contemplate the trust language, trust documents, that judicial confirmation of a successor trustee is required. But here, at least in letter form, that relief was sought and that relief was granted. So that, I think, neutralizes the point that under the trust documents themselves, a new trustee could be appointed without judicial intervention. That may be, but here judicial intervention was sought via letter and obtained via letter. And so it's problematic procedurally from beginning to end. Litigation by letter rather than by the rules of civil procedures, the administrative statutes, and due process is improper. We ask you reverse and remand.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Next, we turn to counsel for the respondent. Again, feel free to adjust the podium as needed. There are 15 minutes on the clock, and you may begin when you are ready.
Excuse me. Members of the court, my name is first initial J. Robert Kina, and I represent respondents Rhonda Conrath, Janet Tharp, and Daniel Roars. They are the siblings of the plaintiff, or of the appellant. This matter is quite simple, and Justice Leder correctly pointed out one simple fact. The interpretation of the trust occurred at this hearing. And I also need to correct a few things. Number one, that was not merely a hearing for the restraining order. In fact, it was another hearing, and they just included that petition at that hearing. And as the court likely has reviewed the transcript from that hearing, in-depth conversations with the court were had regarding the interpretation of the trust. Now, something occurred after.
But isn't it, before you go there, Mr. Kinney, isn't it true there was no specific ruling on the interpretation? There was that comment by the judge and an order denying relief, as I recall, without a memorandum or findings or conclusions.
There was no memorandum. You are correct, Your Honor. And I'll tell you that the denial has more meaning when you consider it for a moment. When one party asks to be named, or one party asks for his brother to be named as the trustee and have the existing trustee replace, and that is denied, and discussions are had regarding following and interpret the language of the trust as the court was interpreting it, that is one issue. But something else happened. In this circumstance, the trustee then resigned. Now, a court has the authority to interpret the trust, and the court did interpret the trust. But what happened once the trustee resigned is that the simple language of the trust was followed. We had been encouraged by the judge to follow the language of the trust, and that she agreed with it. And that is actually an entirely separate issue. Counsel seems to suggest that he did not get an opportunity to be heard on the issue we are here for today. And I would say the issue we are here for today was never pled by them. When you think of it, the issue as to who is named trustee after the resignation of a trustee, that relief was never sought. What they sought was the replacement of the trustee who resigned. So they're here today asking for remand for a remedy they never sought. What we instead know is that the trust specifically, after the provision C, which says what happens on the resignation of the trustee, then says D, the beneficiaries to whom such notice of resignation is given shall designate a successor trustee. It does not require a Rhodes Scholar to interpret what that means. So what occurred was ballots were sent to everyone. Let's the beneficiaries decide who the trustee is. Council's clients refused to return a ballot. Therefore, they were totaled, and even without their ballots, there was a majority which chose Janet Tharp as trustee. This is a separate process, a distinct process, than the process which was litigated at the hearing. Now you may say, well, if that's the case, then why would you ask the court for an order saying that Janet is the trustee? Answer is simple. One of counsel's clients went to the bank and told them that she wasn't. And the bank, therefore, would not let her complete her fiduciary duties. We reference this in our brief. And her fiduciary duties are to pay the expenses for the farm. She had to do what she's now obligated to do as a fiduciary. And therefore, if the bank's not willing to give her the checkbook, the bank wanted that order. Well, we had followed the procedure. No one had objected to the procedure. And the bank wanted the order. That is within the court's inherent power.
And isn't it your client's position that this particular trust language does not require court supervision? So, but for that, as you phrased it, I think interference with the bank, there would not have needed to be a request for a court order.
That's correct. In fact, she went to the bank and wanted to start paying bills, and she wasn't allowed to.
Can I follow up with that? Would you agree that the error might have been entering a judgment as if it needed to be appealed? The only purpose of this order was to confirm what had already occurred, which is the naming of a trustee, a successor trustee that doesn't require court intervention, but you just needed an order to show a judge that this is what the trust in fact determined, and the judge puts a stamp of approval. But given the procedure here, it seems odd that a judgment needed to be entered at all. It strikes me it should not have been an appealable order, and then I wonder what you think would have happened at the scheduling conference in August.
Well, I agree with you. That was a surprise to us all. However, it's harmless error. Because the remedies that they sought in the underlying matter, i.e. the replacement of Marvel, the accounting from Marvel, and all of these things were rendered moot when she resigned and she was gone. The procedures that they sought from the trustee were able to go forward. And it's interesting because what this trust says is now you must sell the, now that the Marvel is resigned, you must sell the land. So what does she do? We notify counsel. We're going to sell the land if it's okay with you because we were just following the terms of the trust. No, absolutely not. So the unusual aspects, i.e. the need for an order naming Janet the trustee, and the unusual fact that Marvel, much to my surprise, I'll be clear, resigned in the middle of this process, all became moot. There was no need. And I suspect that the court recognized the fact that the issues that, if any, that were outstanding were now no longer necessary because now the land is going to be sold. There's this criticism about the nature of the appointment of the trustee and that it was not interim. Well, it was interim. It was supposed to simply be for her to wrap up the estate. She was to get the property appraised and sell it. Then she's done. The trust is over. The trust will be dissolved at that point. But it is not her conduct, it is not my request that she become a long-term trustee with this trust. She was to be an interim trust, and there's only two people who are preventing that. It's not the characterization by us. It was implicit that, well, we're ready to wrap this up, let's put it to bed. But what happens now?
But counsel, if those issues are moot, why not let the district, why was there a final judgment entered on once the replacement was made? Because it seems to me if that's an argument that should be made to the district court before the entire case is dismissed.
I agree with you. And in fact, I would have thought they might have made that argument to the court. They could have said to the court, we think there are some remaining issues. We'd like you to do that. They never did that. In my mind, I didn't object to the court's order because I was thinking to myself, well, the issues are resolved. We're going to sell the property now, so there's no reason for me to make a motion for request for clarification on the order or for further findings, nothing like that. There's no reason for me because what we're going to do then is sell the farm. We intended to. But you are correct. They could have. But ultimately, while I would never criticize the district judge, if there was error, it was harmless error. Because the only thing that could occur in the event that this court were to remand it would be for that court to acknowledge that Marvel is no longer the trustee, do what they've already done, acknowledge that Janet is the trustee, and in that circumstance, follow the language of the trust. I'm not making, when I read from the trust language there, it wasn't a specious interpretation that I was claiming. I just literally read the words. And counsel criticizes me personally on the basis that he said in his brief that we wrongfully stated that they attempted to relitigate this. Well, I'll admit it was a generalization. It's the other brother with the same counsel seeking certain of the same remedies. Counsel says that we made a mistake when we said that the matter in federal court was stayed. Well, I can tell you, although counsel wasn't there, I was. And the judge said that's what she intended to do. And in fact, the federal judge said, as such, this court finds in the interest of both judicial economy and justice are best served by allowing the current appeal and the state action to resolve before this action proceeds further. I wanted to bring that up because the criticism that I read at the end of their reply was pointed directly at me, and I wanted to make sure this court was aware that this did not occur. This was not an attempt to mislead the court. Same is true with regard to our citation to a dissent. Although it's labeled a dissent, it's actually a concurring opinion within that dissent whereby the court says they agree with the majority. I set those aside and I go back to my main points. And my main points is this. The court had made clear that the language of the language governs. Language of the trust governs. Number two, Your Honor correctly pointed out that issue number three, the issue that relates to my client, had already been discussed, argued, and addressed by this judge. It was a short order. I don't see many short orders like that, but you do see some in my 28 years. They're unusual, but they do occur. Next, we have petitioner is plainly unhappy with the missing issues, but could have sought that remedy and could have been presented with the fact that these issues no longer matter. Marvel's gone. Did not. And instead came to this court asking for an entirely different remedy, asking for a remedy whereby Janet will no longer be the trustee. And if that were to occur, this trust would have no trustee, meaning there'd be no trustee, when in fact all that she has done is follow the language of the trust, and that has included soliciting opinions and input from the other side. I digress on that point. So with regard to the fact that the question with regard to due process, I will say this. Number one, due process was had. I am not sure it was required. We made the point, the fact that this may not at all involve a question of due process, but due process was had. They were heard on the issue. With regard to their next essential point, that in addition to a lack of due process, the order was not proper. Well, we pointed out authority for the fact that a court may issue a succinct order like that. It's unusual. I grant that. But more importantly, there is this extraordinarily unusual circumstance we are facing here, whereby we are facing a circumstance whereby even the appellants could get what they want in terms of the cessation of this trust. Nobody, it's not as if they've even alleged that this new trustee is doing things which are outrageous. There's nothing like that going on. And if the decision is upheld, this will take the natural course based on the plain language of the trust.
If the decision's upheld, that's the end of the case, right?
I believe it is.
Litigation's over.
Well, unless the unlikely event that the Supreme Court would want to hear it, but yeah.
Right. But then what happens to the other two claims that were never addressed?
Well, the other two claims that were never addressed relate to conduct of Marble, who is no longer the trustee. The claim with regard to damages...
It seems like those claims, though, are saying, hey, I want an accounting from the trustee. It doesn't necessarily say, I want accounting from Marvel. I want an accounting from the trustee, and that never happened.
And I think you're right. But the fact of the matter is that's not the appeal that was made today. It was an argument made today in court, but that's not the appeal that was made. The attack for this appeal was an attack on the naming of the new trustee.
Well, I think the appeal is also about this litigation is over. If you are successful, that's the end of the litigation. And so the appeal is in part about naming of a new trustee, but it's also you dismiss this entire litigation and we haven't resolved any of our other claims yet.
Well, in my view, there's two things that respond to that. Number one, I think implicit in the court's order is the rejection of those arguments, which were made in the hearing. I attended the hearing. I argued the hearing. I suspect you've seen the transcript. But with regard to something as simple as an accounting, they're entitled to an accounting. Court action wasn't required. But the fact of the matter is they already know the background facts. And I don't want to present background facts to this court that are not in the record. But they already know those facts. And so there is nothing left to litigate. But with regard to the actual remedy they're seeking, the actual appeal that we see on its plain face, separate and distinct from today's oral argument, the remedy is, let's make Janet not the trustee anymore. Let's have no trustee whatsoever. And that's the one that matters to me. If this court were to find that Janet remains the trustee and you want further findings on the other issues from the court, that is certainly something that could occur. But as I explained, those issues are moot. It's that simple. I appreciate this court's time and be glad to answer any additional questions you may have.
It seems to me in the normal sort of course of these proceedings, if a trustee were to, say, die and you're left without a trustee, the court should implement an interim trustee and then you go and litigate it going forward. It seems the letter that got sent talks about the beneficiaries, i.e. all the grantor's children, name the successor to the successor, and ask for an interim order. And what was granted was a final judgment, a final order.
Counsel made that same argument. I don't know that the order naming her trustee was characterized as a final order on the trustee, but what was understood at that time, and is not in the record, was the fact that it was believed then that under the plain language of the trust that the assets would be sold, the money would be divided. That's what the trust says. So in your circumstance, we did not have a trustee who died. We had a trustee who resigned, so we followed the exact procedure written in the trust regarding the resignation.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And we return to counsel for appellant for the final word. There are 5 minutes on the clock. You may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. I'd like to start where my friend on the other side left off, which is the finality of the judgment. If you look at addendum 17 and 18 attached to our opening brief, there can be no reasonable doubt that the trial court intended this as a final judgment. Page 18, addendum or appendix 18, it is stamped, judgment was entered on July 19th, 2023. Above that, entry of judgment is also stamped. Back on page 17, if you look at the it's in small letters, but the file stamp of the clerk says, I certify the above order constitutes the judgment of the court, signed by the court administrator. This was a final judgment, and it does dispose of all claims, including those three backwards-looking claims that were not adjudicated below.
But counsel, what's your basis for saying that? I ask that because you look at this order, and it simply appoints the successor and enters judgment. Mm-hmm. If I recall correctly, the order in May, was it, or earlier in the summer maybe, that addressed the issues from April 5 hearing did not have an entry of judgment, so it was not appealable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
By deduction, that mean all the issues that were not raised or resolved on an appealable basis from that hearing are still live today.
Your Honor, the court below closed its file, closed the case. I think that's a all relief not herein granted is denied situation.
Administratively,
from,
you mean it's closed, but
it is.
It kind of goes to my earlier question, and maybe what Judge Schmidt was getting at that too. It just seems like the only thing we have in front of us here, whether we affirmed or reversed, would only direct that judgment from August or July 11, appointing a successor, but would not have really addressed any of the other issues because there's no other issues before us.
And I think that's the problem, Your Honor, that what my friends on the other side probably should have done is, rather than litigating by letter, filed a motion to dismiss based on mootness or whatever other theories they have. We would have responded, there would have been a hearing, and there would have been a coherent ruling from the trial court. That simply didn't happen here. Instead, we have this ad hoc light-speed procedure from July 7th through July 11th, and finally on July 19th, with no opportunity for us to respond, because there is no motion live, no hearing, and no adjudication of certain issues, despite the purported finality of this judgment. It also contains the traditional indicia of finality, that phrase, let judgment be entered accordingly. The trial court believed this was a case-resolving, case-dispositive order. I don't believe that it reaches three of the five live claims, and therefore a remand is necessary to adjudicate those claims and also to allow us the opportunity to respond and be heard on the successor trustee issue, because recall that one of the claims in my client's live petition was for interpretation of trust language because of this dispute, and they might not like our position, they may think we're wrong, but we have a right to present our argument on the meaning of Section 7B and 7D in the trust. We were never afforded that opportunity below. I want to speak briefly to the April 5th preliminary injunction hearing. My friends on the other side indicated it was more than a preliminary injunction hearing. If you look at the transcript of it, the court's opening remark, page 2 of the transcript, line 5, through 6. This matter is on the calendar for a motion for preliminary injunction. Further down the page, lines 22 through 24, as I indicated, this is a hearing on the preliminary injunction matter. The trial court plainly thought it was having a preliminary injunction hearing, not a trial on the merits or on any other dispositive motion. And our jobs as advocates and judges would all be a lot easier if a preliminary injunction hearing was the same thing as a trial on the merits. They're a lot shorter, they're a lot more compact, they move a lot faster, and you can get to them a lot faster. Unfortunately, a preliminary injunction hearing is not a hearing on a dispositive motion, and it's not a trial on the merits. To suggest that the April 5th hearing somehow makes proper the July 7th through July 11th light-speed litigation by letter is improper. The PI hearing had nothing to do with that because the decision that they were asking the court to judicially recognize had not occurred yet. And so that remains a live issue. It was unpleaded for relief. Again, I think this is just a matter of following proper procedures. Procedure counts. Procedure matters. It's what prevents us from having to speculate as to what the trial court meant and what the trial court was doing. And I again thank the court for the opportunity to appear on a pro hoc basis. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments as well as the briefing. The case is submitted, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame.
And
with that, we are closed for today.